Hey, hey, welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We made it to June in our first season, and we finally made it to one of my favorite guests, really, to talk about just about anything. I'm Scott Pianowski, your host, and I'm joined by Michael Salfino, a very dear old friend and a linchpin of the fantasy industry. If you want to read Michael, he's all over the place, man. 538, he's part of the Murderers Row over at The Athletic. He does music on Paste. He's writing stuff for baseball, for Topps baseball cards now. Of course, he's part of the Breakfast Table podcast with some other clown. I can't remember his name, but Michael Salfino on Twitter. I probably left out about two or three gigs that he's got. Michael Salfino, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, pleasure to have you on.
This and long time coming.
Well, you can check this one off the bucket list.
We haven't spoken on a podcast in like 3 days. So,
you know, I know the podcast must be doing well when people are actually asking to be on it, which is that you didn't ask. You waited for me to ask you, but I actually have had people request to be on it now. So I figure we're doing something right. And if you agree, why not go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review and you know, use all your big words and your vocabulary and make us look good. But that's for later. Let's give you a great show. You know, Michael could talk about any baseball team, but because he's so close to the Mets, I feel like that's a great place to start. Jacob DeGrom was a first-round pick in most leagues, was somebody who some people thought maybe even the top number one pitcher off the board. And he's had a little bit of a disappointing season. I feel like that's kind of a theme with all the Mets pitchers. I'm in a league that I co-own with my friend Scott Gleason. We drafted DeGrom in the first round. And he said to me this week, he wants to get out of the DeGrom business. He's hoping DeGrom can have a big game and maybe we can sell him. What do you think of Jacob DeGrom for the rest of the season?
It's weird. Like, all the Mets pitchers are almost like forced holds right now. Matt's probably no one's going to believe it given his injury history. And the other guys are not cuttable since they flash, but they're not really tradable since you're worried that you're selling low. So I get the idea of waiting for DeGrom to have an explosive DeGrom-like outing, at least, you know, as relates to 2018, if not 2019. The velocity, and this is the case with all the Mets pitchers, like their velocity is very good. Maybe it's too good. Maybe it's too consistent. Like, that's my sort of pet theory. And that's the analysis that we did for the Wall Street Journal with my colleague there, Andrew Beaton, where we said that the pitchers who have low fastball speed variants are pitchers that are not only prone to injury, but also less effective. So I think that that's kind of a problem with this staff. I would be holding DeGrom, though. I still believe in him as a Cy Young caliber pitcher. And it's really hard to trade an asset like that that you've invested in at this point of the season, because he's capable of just going off on an epic string of starts at any point. So no matter where you sit in the standings, that's going to be something that's extremely valuable, and it's something very few other starters can offer.
Here's where I struggle with DeGrom, and I'm a big fan of DeGrom. I love watching him pitch. I love guys who have the type of control he has, and he's got a certain makeup that I find appealing too. Plus, whenever you turn into a DeGrom start, you get that Mets broadcast booth, which now that Vin Scully's retired, I think a Mets broadcast is as good as you're going to get these days. Those guys are terrific, and get well soon, Ron Darling. But if you take out last year's DeGrom season, I mean, he did it, so it counts. It's not like it doesn't count. But this year, 3.49 ERA, 1.15 WHIP. In 2017, it was 3.53 ERA, 1.19 WHIP. And in 2016, it was 3.04 ERA, 1.20 WHIP. Are those the numbers we should be expecting? Like, maybe an ERA in the mid to low threes and a WHIP in the 1.15 to 1.20 area, where it's almost like he's a starting a soft ace, maybe even a starting pitcher too. Is that more maybe the realistic place for DeGrom? Of course, this is arbitrary endpoints, because in 2015, his ERA was in the mid-2s. His WHIP was below 1. Where would you set an over-under for him the rest of the way?
What's his walk rate this year relative to his historical walk rate?
It's just slightly above his career average. 2.45 per 9. It's 2.24 for 9. His strikeouts are also over his career average as well. The home run rate over average, FIP suggests a slightly, actually FIP and XFIP are right in line with his ERA. They say his ERA is really where it should be right now.
Sort of like the hidden issue or the hazard with all Mets pitchers is that their defense is just so completely horrendous that I think it inflates all of their WHIPs. I don't know. It's hard to precisely quantify it, but they are historically bad and consistently bad in defensive BABIP. So that I think is going to be a drag on a whip that maybe like in a more neutral defensive environment or even in a good defensive environment, DeGrom's whip would probably be right around one. And I think that's sort of the tax you pay for all these pitchers for pitching on the Mets. Last year, he just defied that gravity, but other pitchers sort of succumbed to it. So maybe it's a little bit of payback now, but I really think that the Mets defense is a problem with owning Mets pitchers.
Right. Let's go to Syndergaard. This is a guy, you catch him on the right day, you wonder how he ever loses. Strikeout rate is just a shade over 9, which surprises me. His ERA is almost 5. He has been unlucky. FIP says 3.63. XFIP has him at 3.78. Home run rate is, I think, the highest since his rookie year. But I can't help but think when I watch Syndergaard that something doesn't add up here. I almost get a little bit of the Strasburg reaction that I have where he gets hurt a lot, and I feel like he should be contending for Cy Young's, and he really hasn't hit that level yet. Give us a check-in on Syndergaard.
Well, you know, he's the guy that we targeted in that article as somebody who really does not vary his fastball variance. And, you know, Brandon McCarthy backstage or maybe on stage on Twitter said that, you know, it's unrealistic to expect that these pitchers can moderate their velocity within these narrow parameters that were prescribed by the doctors that we cited in the piece, which was plus or minus 2 miles an hour from average. I don't understand why that's that big of a deal, to be honest with you. But whether it is difficult to do or whether it's easier to do, I think the point is that it needs to be done. So I think when you're just pumping in 98 miles an hour, pitch after pitch after pitch after pitch, it's like, you know, the hitters get into a groove where it's just like the fast cage. They're going to be able to time that up at some point. If you go from 95 to 99, that to me makes you much more difficult to square up. But as far as like his straight stuff is concerned, he's struggling with a slider, and he also has a very low spin rate for, you know, which does not obviously correlate to velocity, which is counterintuitive. I would think that it would, but that I think argues against his increased usage of the four seam fastball. Like to me, that's a spin rate pitch. Right. But if you just naturally have a lower spin rate, why not throw the two seamer, which he had done early in his career? And sure, it's going to knock your strikeout rate down. But if you can be not, you know, a strikeout per inning plus a, you know, 55% ground ball rate, 60% ground ball rate, that to me is the time tested formula for ERA dominance.
Right. Yeah. You think back to Felix Hernandez's salad days. You love those guys with the strikeouts and the ground balls. Wheeler's an interesting case to me. And I know Zach Wheeler was somebody you said I should target in my second chance draft about a week ago. And I actually did get Zach Wheeler, and I'm hoping he can be a difference maker for me. His strikeouts is under 9. It was 8.8 a year ago. Now it's over 10. His walk rate is just about the same. Velocity is actually up a tick. It's up a mile per hour. XFIP and FIP have his ERA a solid run lower than where the 4.68 is. And maybe that's the Mets defense talking. Home run rate is up a little bit. I remember Wheeler went on a mad run the second half of last season, so we know what's possible. But you know, maybe, you know, I haven't really thought about this defense much until this conversation. I mean, maybe just these guys can't afford to have the ball in play because they're going to get sunk in by somebody. In fact, tell me what positions, because I haven't watched the Mets as closely as you. I'm not even sure off the top of my head who's sinking them. Are you optimistic that maybe Wheeler will be better, at least better than he's pitched so far?
Well, all the Mets defensive positions are bad. or at least...
Even Rosario's not a plus defender?
No, definitely okay. Not. Okay. Which is surprising. Like, he seems to have... He's like all tools, no toolbox when it comes to defense. I mean,
he was a top 5 prospect at one point, and most of it I thought was about his defense. But it doesn't mean it has to hash out that way.
I want to hurl those prospect guys to the moon, into the sun for those Rosario touts, which you know I take at face value. I just don't understand how that guy could have been a top 5 prospect. I don't get it whatsoever. Like I feel. Mets fans have been so disappointed by that, but it's really not their fault. They didn't get ahead of the market. This was the market. This guy was supposed to be very good. And to me, like he's at best going to be an average player when you factor in the entire package. Wheeler is another guy.
Hang on one second. Before you go into Wheeler, let me ask you this. This is something I struggle with. Other than watching games, and again, you're watching the Mets every night, but so that's a great way to get a sense of a defense. Have we come up with a statistical way of breaking down? Because this has been a long debated thing with the fantasy community and with the stat community, is that can we trust defensive metrics, or is there something we can point to? Some people will say, oh, you know, WAR is misleading because it makes you think Jason Hayward's this player that he's not, and the defensive metrics don't make sense. And, oh, look, Mike Trout got a negative score this year, blah, blah, blah. How do you, again, you watch the Mets every night. That's the best way to get a sense of who's got a good defense, is watching them like you're a beat writer. But short of that, how can we get, what do you look at to identify where the good defenses are and where the bad defenses are?
Well, I respect the team-wide stats. So the ones that you cited, I think are very reliable and accurate. On the individual level, I have a lot of skepticism of those stats, just because most of the modern defensive metrics don't take into account positioning and shifting. So things that grade as really good plays as far as zone rating just assume that the player is in a normal defensive alignment. I mean, he may not have even have moved and have caught and caught that ball. So basically, I think you kind of have to watch the individual player, but I don't think you have to watch the team. I think you could look at the team-wide data for the Mets, for example, and just say this is a bad defensive team, and have that not only be descriptive but predictive of their defensive performance going forward.
It is fascinating to me looking at the defensive WAR stats for teams on FanGraphs, and every team that's considered a quote-unquote smart team does well in defense, it seems like, and every team that's considered maybe behind the analytics wave is one of the laggers in this. It's almost every team. Think of a team you think are smart, like the Astros are eighth, the Athletics are sixth, the Rays are third. And you think of the teams that were late to the sabermetric revolution, like the Pirates or the Orioles, they're in the mid to low 20s. It just seems, it's funny how this seems to line up with what your intuitive guess would be.
Well, and ironically, the first wave of Moneyball and analytics was that defense was overvalued and to just get hitting at those positions. That was Bean's sort of invention.
That is fascinating. Let's get back to Wheeler again. You were high on him before the season, and even a week or two ago, you were promoting me to get him. ERA right now, 4.68. FIP says 3.34, XFIP 3.56. So obviously outpitching what that front door ERA says. But again, he's going to beat the defense. I like the fact that the strikeouts are up. He's throwing a little bit harder. Where do we go from here with Wheeler?
I like the FIP projection going forward. I think I would bet on an ERA around 3.5. I think there's upside from there, especially when you factor in that second half of 2018 that you cited. The stuff is certainly elite. The thing that's weird about him, and this is using the inside edge stats right now, but what's unusual about him, and these stats always track, and these are two things that I look for in the dominance category, and that's percentage of outs that are Ks in four pitches or less. He's 19%. The league average is 14%. That's like an A-minus. That's exactly what you would expect. But then his swing and miss percentage of strikes, 17%, which is actually slightly below league average at 18%. You hardly ever see a divergence of those two stats. And I don't really understand what that means as far as Wheeler is concerned. Maybe he is struggling with the swing and miss, but then, like you said, you cited that his K rate is really good. So I just think that the Mets pitchers generally have to operate under the weight of knowing that if they put the ball in play, something bad could happen. And I don't really think that that's an efficient way to pitch. And when you look at the efficiency stats as far as like pitches per inning, that those are things that could really be negatively influenced by that. Like if you're just working deeper into counts, I don't have the data in front of me to see if that's an issue with Wheeler, but I think Wheeler is a really good bet for 3.4, 1.15 going forward.
I would certainly take that. You know, Matt's is fascinating to me because I always want to believe that maybe there's a number two or number three pitcher here, even if it doesn't slot that way on the Mets. And sometimes I'll look at that 3.97 ERA he has this year, identically the same ERA he had last year. And I think, well, he had that one game against the Phillies, didn't have it, he didn't get out of the first inning. And, I can wipe that off the slate. I don't have a problem with that. but his FIP is actually almost 5, and his XFIP is over 4. Strikeouts are about the same as last year. His control's gotten a little bit better, a little bit more homer prone this year. Is there a ceiling with Mats, or he's 28 now? Is this kind of, this is who he is? Or do you think there's any reason for optimism that he'd be better going forward?
He's got the lowest overall report card grade of the Mets pitchers. He's got like a C+, which, you know, obviously is close to average. And I think that that's a reasonable place for where he should sit. He's got excellent velocity, especially for a lefty. But, you know, the dominant stats are below par. He's, you know, 15%. Percentage of outs that are K's in 4 pitches or less, 33% 1-2-3 innings as a percentage of completed innings. He's 33%, league average is 37%. He's well below average in swing and miss percentage of strikes, 14% versus 18% league wide. You hate to see somebody who's supposed to be a pitcher who can flash dominance be below average in those dominant statistics. So, and even his command and working ahead of the count is close to average. The only thing where he's grading above average is off speed effectiveness. But, you know, obviously that's more of a secondary thing, you know, both literally and figuratively, where you need to really be able to get guys out and to get ahead of the count with your fastball for those off-speed pitches, I think, to be leveraged effectively.
Before we get out of the Mets for the time being, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Michael Conforto. Some people were thinking maybe a 35 or 40 home run season was realistic for him. He just has the 10 home runs. He's hitting .251 right now, which I guess is his career average. This is another player where I thought maybe he could be a star, maybe like a down ballot MVP guy. And right now he's just a solid player. He hasn't really taken that next step. Any optimism that something good might be coming from Conforto?
Well, he's missed time, and he walks a lot. On a per-game basis, I did the stats last week, so it may have changed, but I don't really consider homers. He hasn't hit a homer in the last week. He hit the grand slam, and he was out for a while. But basically, what I found was that if you look at Conforto's stats prior to his shoulder operation or injury in 2017, he was at about a 36 home run pace per 150 games. If you look at him from the second half to basically about now, he's at the same rate of about 35 homers per 150 games. So I think that's pretty much who he is. I think he's, you know, a 35 homer, 380 to 410 OPS guy. I think on base percentage guy. I think his on base percentage now is still over 400, or it's right around there. So to me, that's a really effective offensive player. The problem that you have with Conforto is with the Mets struggling to score runs is that the counting stats are always going to fall short, I think, of what they would be in a better offensive environment.
Let me just ask you off the cuff. Don't think, just give me your first instinct. Would you rather have Andrew McCutchen or Michael Conforto?
Oh, Conforto, for sure. Like I want the more projectable power almost always.
Benintendi or Conforto?
Again, power, Conforto. I don't really know what Benintendi gives you that's bettable at this point. Like, to me, he's...
I guess the thing with me is I just always like being insulated by the lineup in the park, and I feel like just by being around all those other good offensive players, it's going to keep... There's a buoyancy to Benintendi that maybe Conforto doesn't have.
Yeah, what are his counting stats right now in runs and RBIs, Benintendi's?
I'm going to look those up right now. And the thing with McCutchen is, I mean, he's going to score 125 runs. Right now, Benintendi is .259, 27 runs, 6 homers, 26 RBIs, and 7 stolen bases.
Yeah, I can't see that. Like, I don't understand. To me, this guy, maybe he's Markakis with a little bit more speed, but even Markakis at his age was pretty much doing the same thing, even in the steals category, if I recall correctly. I don't get it. Like, to me, he's definitely a guy that you could, who's mixed league worthy, who could be part of a championship team if things pop right, especially for him in the average category. And I don't think he's a .259 hitter, but he just doesn't give you anything that's going to move the needle anywhere.
No, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Let's stick with the National League East and talk about another pitcher that I think that you like. You did a recent piece on The Athletic. I believe it drops today about certain teams that have scheduling advantages. The Twins come out really well in that because they have that really soft landing in the AL Central. And the Braves were another team that you like from a schedule standpoint. And that may set up a buying opportunity for Julio Teheran, who at one point was a really touted prospect. And then he just morphed into being a serviceable pitcher. He's had some seasons that are better than others. Some seasons he's been a fantasy factor all year. He's had other seasons he's had struggled to keep the ERA in a playable area. But you like Teheran going forward.
Yeah, well, first let's set the table. The two divisions you want to be in terms of low OPS for their hitters. And this is something that I wrote about in February for the Athletic Draft Kit. And people were like, well, it's a new year. But really, the takeaway was that the outlying divisions were the NL East and AL Central. And those are the divisions in which you should target your pitchers to get that tailwind, right? Because we have, people may not realize, but 76 games per team are played inside their division. So, and that's borne out. The NL East is the lowest OPS division at 725, AL Central second lowest at 729. And then you get the AL West at 781 if you want to see the, like the range, right? But then the other thing that you do, like the second level thing to do, is to back out, well, is the OPS heavily weighted with one team? Because then if you get pitchers on that team, you're golden, right? And that's a huge factor in the AL Central, which actually becomes the worst hitting division in baseball if you own Twins pitchers, because the Twins are the number one OPS team, right? So if you take the Twins pitchers, obviously don't have to face themselves. So the rest of that division is below 700, which is anemic. And you don't get that same thing with the Braves pitchers, but you know they also are the best hitting team in the NL East, just not to the degree to which the Twins are in the Central. But the interesting thing is not every team at this point of the season has played the same number of games in the, inside their division. So you have the Twins have only played 14 games inside the AL
wow,
Central.
Wow, there's only been 14 games. Interesting.
Yeah.
So they get all the soft games coming.
Yes,
exactly. And already right. They're the best team in baseball. Right now, I think they have the best record. They just won three in a row from Tampa.
And also the Braves have 15 games. Now, in the through yesterday, and it didn't matter because the Mets are playing outside the division, the Mets had 31 games, right? And the Braves had 15 inside the NL East. And in the AL Central, it was the range was the White Sox had the most with 29. And then the Twins had the least with 14. You could see like there's a huge difference there. I mean, the White Sox pitchers have only faced the Twins three of their 19 times that they're going to face them. So they have 16 games remaining with the Twins, even though they've played the most games in the AL Central. So that's a headwind for the White Sox staff. So I think, you know, these are the things that are kind of like right there in plain sight, hiding in plain sight, that I think if you are aware of them and your opponents in your league are not, you can get 5 cents on the dollar in a trade without them even knowing it. You know what I mean? Because you're just taking, you're leveraging this divisional advantage by not only targeting the teams in the weakest division, but the team with the best offense in the weakest division, and then the teams with the fewest games in the weakest division in the season to date.
I'm wondering who the buy is on the Twins. And the reason I say that is because I think Berríos is a fairly known commodity. And even though he's only been merely good, he hasn't been the breakout star that I thought he might be. His owner is going to want a lot for him. And Odorizzi has pitched so great, and I know they shield him away from going deep into games and facing those lineups, you know, third and fourth time. They don't want him to do that. So he's going to be a 5 or 6 inning pitcher. But his numbers are so good, it's just one of the – he becomes a forced hold because his owner can't assume that it just goes away and you can't pay for the high end of the range. Pineda's hurt right now. Is Martin Perez the buy here? They've had some call-ups to fill in the rotation.
Plus he gave up 6 runs on Thursday. So Perez – would be a guy to go after. But why not Smeltzer? Like, I don't know what Pineda's status is, but the guy is always hurt. He's got chronic knee problems. He's big-bodied, big-boned. So, you know, I don't know how – it sounds like something that could linger, right? And Smeltzer was so effective in his first start. He's only 20% owned on Yahoo. Why not stream him for now, for sure?
Yeah, take a chance. Yeah, there's plausible upside here. I like that a lot. I do feel good that the Twins and the AL Central were something that we were definitely on this podcast and in my column before the year. At one point, I added up all the over-unders in division. Basically, you know, for the Twins, just add up the win total expected over-under for the other four teams. And they had one of the best attack rates of that stat. They might have even been first. I remember looking at a bunch of stuff in the Twins. And by the end of the spring training, you know, maybe mid to late March, I said, you know what? They're going to win this division. I actually put that in my bold predictions that the Twins would win the division. And that looks like that's such a lock right now. I mean, they're 10 and a half games up on Cleveland. We didn't get specifically into Tehran. You've been on. It's interesting. When people were in on Tehran, it felt like you were out.
Yeah,
now that people are kind of out on Tehran, it feels like you're in. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I'm very proud of that. And this is not like you don't want to be the person who says, hey, look, I was right about something, and just have that be the end of the story. But I think it's fair to say when something works out, what the process was, because then maybe that process can be transferable to other situations and other players. So,
exactly.
So with Tehran, it was, I just never thought that he was ace worthy. When people were expecting that from him, I never saw it. I never saw him being a dominant pitcher. So I was lower than the market. But then when he fell short of that, and the market overcorrected, and then he was like pretty much trash. Like I got him in every single draft with a pocket pick. That's like the old Gil Brandt saying, where you put the pick in your pocket and you take it out of your pocket whenever you feel like, because you know nobody else is going to use it. You know, so it's just, you just wait for as long as you feel comfortable, and then boom, you just take him. And that's what I did. You know, he's not great, but he's got like a 0.83 ERA, which is obviously ridiculous over his last six starts. He's got all these games coming against the weak NL East teams. He's on the best team in the NL East, and nobody really wants the guy still. And to me, you know, he's a solid back end fantasy starter, which is what I always thought he was. So when people were radically downgrading him, I was just mildly downgrading him. Like he was basically like, he never really got out of the bucket that I thought he was in to begin with.
Yeah. Just looking at some of the guys, he's 58% owned on Yahoo right now. And just to put that in context, Chris Archer is in the 60s. Dallas Keuchel, who I still think is going to be a month away, even if he signs with anybody, he's in the 60s. Porcello is 68%. J.A. Happ is 69%. They're not having great seasons. Yu Darvish, who I wouldn't trust as far as I could throw him, 71% owned. I mean, I don't know. I think Tehran, you could probably trade Tehran for some of these guys and maybe even get a sweetener.
Well, trade some of those guys for Tehran, right?
Right, exactly. I'm sorry, I flipped that, but right.
Yeah, exactly. Or just pick Tehran up for nothing, since, you know, he's available. I think yesterday, before the start yesterday, he was available in 48% of Yahoo leagues. Like, I don't know, like, what that number is right now, because he had another five innings. Like, he throws too many pitches. There are flaws. Like, this guy is not great. He didn't get a win again, but, you know, I don't really buy the theory that, oh, you want your pitchers to pitch more innings because that gives them a higher win probability. To me, if they can get through the five innings, why do you want that guy going through these more marginal pitchers going through the lineup three or four times? Just get him out of there.
That's a great point. His last six starts have been between five and six innings. So I haven't followed closely, but
three runs and six starts.
Right. That's maybe they're doing the Odorizzi with him, right? Which is saying, okay, look, you're getting 27 batters more or less, and when that fourth or 20 batters, 23 batters, whatever it is, but you're not going deep into that third cycle through. Odorizzi never pitches more than six innings, and a lot of times it's only five. Get us a lead, and then we'll work on it from there.
Exactly right. And remember, just because you leave with a one-run lead, that doesn't mean that that lead is as shaky as it might seem, because your hitters get a chance to add to that lead, and then you still get the win, you know? So basically, I just think he's just free loot right there if he's sitting there on waivers. Just, like, get him. Like, to me, he should be 100% owned in a 12-team league. Somebody should have him as, like, their sixth or seventh starter.
Now, if you were out in front of the Lucas Giolito story, you're making money hand over fist. He's actually the number one ranked fantasy pitcher over the last month. ERA barely over one, a whip of 0.69, 48 strikeouts, 43 and two-thirds innings. He's won six games, which, you know, you have to look at some of that as flukiness, but, I mean, two of them have been complete games. He almost completed his game on Sunday maybe just a reminder that to throw out when young pitchers struggle doesn't really matter. Just maybe at some point keep in mind they could put it together. Are you believing that this Giolito story is legitimate? Is he here to stay as a fantasy ace?
Well, I like Giolito when he was a prospect. And I thought that the Mets like really blew it by not picking him in that 2012, I think it was, draft when he was available to them with the 12th pick because he was coming off Tommy John surgery. But then I thought, hey, sometimes Tommy John surgery just doesn't work out. And he had dropped his velocity so much from his high school days. Like he had lost like 3 or 4 miles an hour from his high school days. So I thought that that story was pretty much over and the Giolito ship had sailed. But then this year, in classic sort of post-hype fashion, he regained that velocity that he had lost. And I guess sometimes like it takes a while for that stuff to come back and for pitchers to fully heal. And maybe there's a lesson in that for him. But, you know, obviously I think the concerns now is like how sustainable is this given his prior workload in his career? Like, is this a pace that he can sustain just in terms of endurance? Has he ever really been tested in pitching this much? So what I suggested in that athletic piece is that I thought that you could probably, Giolito is so trendy right now and is so well regarded, especially on fantasy Twitter, that I think that you could probably get Berrios for him and maybe like a slightly better hitter for the slightly worse pitcher. Slightly worse hitter. So like the sort of the 2 for 2. So you're not sort of telegraphing it. And I wouldn't put Giolito over Berrios for the rest of the season, even though he's so far above him for the season to date. I don't know where you stand on that though.
I would rather have Berrios because I want the good stuff around him. And again, as you mentioned, he never has to face the Twins. But I do think Giolito is going to be a difference maker. He's going to be somebody you're going to set and forget the rest of the year. I like the fact that he wasn't just a prospect. He was at one point the number one pitching prospect in baseball. So there was an implied gigantic ceiling with Giolito. You talked about that 2012 draft. We're taping this on June 3rd, which is MLB draft day, which is why people are holding on to Keuchel and holding on to Craig Kimbrel because they're hoping they're going to sign now that the compensation window is closed there. But a fascinating draft. Carlos Correa went first, Byron Buxton second, Kevin Gausman, who I guess I should probably ask you a question about him in a second. He was the 4th overall pick. David Dahl went 10th. The Mets, you remember the Mets, they took Gavin Cecchini, shortstop, who I guess got a cup of coffee with the Mets, but basically didn't make it. Tyler Nyquist was the 15th pick. And then Giolito, despite Tommy John surgery. Did you know, by the way, Tommy John himself doesn't want people to have Tommy John surgery? He thinks it's like an epidemic and it's ruining all these young kids. It's this kind of fascinating little side note there. But yeah, Giolito, part of a really fascinating 2012 draft class.
Yeah. And then the Mets passed up McCullers, who's hurt now, but still I would rather have him for Plawecki in the 2nd round, if I recall correctly, because the Mets just don't have any money. Like that's the horrible story for Mets fans. And that's a scandal that's going to be reported on widely in future decades about how the Mets fan base has pretty much been abandoned by Major League Baseball. And the Wilpons have been allowed to own the team despite not having apparently the financial wherewithal to actually run a franchise. But as far as Giolito goes, you know, everything kind of like lines up with him for sure. And there's no doubting his ability. I just would worry about not so much like a risk of re-injury or any of this Verducci stuff with like, you know, the innings thresholds. Like I don't really put a lot of stock into them, but I just think it's obviously much harder to pitch as the season goes on if you're not sort of trained for that. You know, if you haven't passed that threshold and hit that wall and gone through it previously in your career.
You're listening to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm Scott Pianowski, your host. We're joined by Michael Salfino of The Athletic and about 15 other websites and of the Breakfast Table Podcast. Mike, today is Monday. It's draft day. I'm mostly a redraft fantasy player with baseball. I don't play in a lot. I play in one keeper league. I don't have any dynasty formats. So for me, I'll look at the draft a little bit, but I know most of these guys, even the people who may come quickly. Like I think of Casey Mize, who was the Tiger pitcher, who was drafted number one overall last year. I mean, it seems like he's really close to being ready. The only thing that might hold him back is that the team is so bad, they have no reason to really push him. But I'm curious how you suggest people in redraft leagues should digest the draft at all. And I know you play in some dynasty formats. I mean, what does draft day mean to you and how do we apply it for fantasy? I know, very contextual question, but just give us some general thoughts on the draft.
Well, the biggest takeaway that you should have about this draft for and obviously we're looking at it in a fantasy context. So I think the major pitfall is that in fantasy is that we tend to extrapolate the prospect rankings into fantasy rankings, which they are not. So guys like great hitting first basemen who are going to be gold in fantasy are not well regarded as prospects. So one of the things that you should always do is look to see the highest rated prospect first baseman on the list of top prospects and take that guy in your dynasty team, because you don't care about positional value. You just want the hitting stats, right? And so there's a guy actually in this draft this year that is probably the greatest college hitter who's ever lived and is probably not going to be the number one overall pick, may not even be a top five overall pick, is probably pegged right now to go at number three. And that guy is Andrew Vaughn, who also is a right-handed hitting first baseman, which people don't like, and obviously not very athletic, but this dude is just insane. I mean, this year his OPS for California in the Pac-12 is 1276. He's got 53 walks, 30 strikeouts, 15 homers, right? 539 on base percentage. Last year he had 18 strikeouts and 23 homers. Like this year, they're just not giving him anything to hit because California's team is just so bad that they're just throwing him breaking balls out of the strike zone. So that's the reason why some of his counting stats are down. But this guy will instantly be the best hitting prospect in baseball. And I'd be absolutely flabbergasted if he's not raking in the major leagues by next July.
Yeah, I never really thought about this. You talked about them not liking right-handed first baseman. What's the thought process behind that?
I think it just sort of like feeds into itself. Like the Ringer had a story that ran yesterday, I think, where they talked about this and they said how, you know, one right-handed first baseman has gone like in the top five picks. It was like this guy, David McCarthy, I think, for the Mariners. But, you know, those things always get a little bit cute because Frank Thomas went eighth. He was a right-handed hitting first baseman. He's fine. Obviously a Hall of Famer, one of the greatest hitters of all time. I don't really understand especially in the era of the shift, why it's such a disadvantage to be a right-handed hitting first baseman versus a left-handed hitting first baseman.
Could it be a defensive? Is there something defensive about wanting to have a lefty at first base?
Easier
for him to make the throw. He doesn't have to pivot, right?
It's obviously better
across the diamond.
It's obviously better to be a left-handed throwing first baseman, but. You know, the other thing is that if you're a first baseman and you're left-handed, that really cuts into your positional flexibility as well, because then it's harder to go. Are there left-handed throwing left fielders? Is that a thing? Or do people not care about that?
I never really thought about that much, but I guess I can see it because it's just the 3-6-3 double play. The righty always has to shift his body, where the lefty can naturally just step into the throw. So I guess that makes sense. One of my favorite little draft day nuggets, I know this is a favorite player of yours, Christian Yelich was as much a first baseman as anything in high school. He also played some outfield, but he was drafted. I think his early prospect draft rankings had him as a first baseman. It's just so funny. You think of the defensive spectrum, you get the first base at the end of the rainbow. It's when they've given up playing you anywhere else and they have to put you at first base. Or maybe you're just one of those slow guys or a left-handed slow guy who can't play anywhere else. So first base is where they stick you. It's fascinating to see a player like Yelich who actually moved the other way on the defensive spectrum as a pro.
Yeah, and Bellinger's like that too.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, Bellinger can't play first base now just because they want to protect his shoulder on dives. But, you know, that guy can play center field. He and Yelich are so similar.
I want to get two more quick player takes, and then we're going to morph into our draft. You were talking about the Braves schedule earlier. I have some Kevin Gausman shares. He got his lunch handed to him last week, but it was one of those things, mostly singles, just kind of, you know, BABIP to death. It wasn't home runs or anything. Now his ERA, of course, is a mess. He ruined my week in a league that's weekly scoring. Do you have the stomach to start Gausman going forward? Does he need to do something to prove he's in the circle of trust? Is he even good enough to be rosterable? This guy was batting practice fodder for such a long time in Baltimore, and then he had a really nice finish last year in Atlanta. Just give us a quick take on Gausman.
I like having the tailwind of the division and all those remaining games. I would definitely, since he's going to be available on the waiver wire in most 12-team mixed leagues right now, I would definitely pick him up. Like, to me, like, that's a no-brainer to just see. Like, I'm not saying to give him a long leash. If he performs poorly in your first couple of starts, then just broom him. But if he manages to flash something that people expected in the winter for you, then I think I would even give him the leash of one bad start.
You said something fascinating on Twitter over the weekend about Jose Ramirez. You compared him to a player from a past generation. He's obviously been one of the most difficult players for fantasy owners to get a handle on. And when they hear the comparison you're going to make, I don't think they're going to be very excited. So if you're listening to this in the car and you're a Ramirez owner, you might want to pull over. Tell everybody your stance right now on Jose Ramirez.
Well, it's just so, it's so obvious to compare him to such a similar player on the same team, which is Carlos Baerga, who everybody thought was on a Hall of Fame trajectory through age 24, let's call it. And then he even through age 25, because that was the strike shortened year. So he was performing at his rate stats in that season as well. And then he started to slide a little bit at age 26, but still made the All-Star team. And then he cratered, and then the Mets, of course, stepped in and said, hey, we'll take Carlos Baerga. Like, this is free money. Like, this guy's maybe a Hall of Famer. We're going to be able to trade for him? Sure. And then, of course, you know, the Indians got out at the right time. And I think, did the Mets trade Jeff Kent?
Oh, God, I hope not. Jeff Kent, Jeff Kent's one of the most underrated players in baseball history. He has a very legitimate
Hall of Fame case. He was traded for Jeff Kent.
Oh, man. Yeah, because Kent, wasn't the most popular guy in the locker room. But, if a guy can hit, find a way to make that work. Do you think it's possible Baerga might have been older than his reported age? Whenever guys lose it really quickly, I wonder if that could maybe be part of it.
Well, pre-9/11, like, I think all of that stuff is suspicious, but maybe not. Like, look at Ramirez, isn't? And Ramirez right now, you know me. I've said this a million times. Bet the base rate. And the base rate for Ramirez is just take all the Ramirez you can acquire and just wait for him to regress in a positive sense to his career rates. But this is a prolonged slump for a guy like for out of nowhere. I mean, we're talking about a guy who has a 66 OPS plus. He was 150 last year, and in the first half, he was battling Trout for the pre-injury Trout for WAR. He was going to be at over 10 wins.
He was one of the MVP front runners right there with Betts and Trout. I mean, and then Ramirez fell off. The thing that worries me is he's been bad for a long period of time. I know it's arbitrary endpoints, but he had a terrible second half, and now he's had a terrible 2 months. The only thing that's really keeping you afloat here is he's running a lot and he's walking a lot. So he's got the 30 walks and the 14 stolen bases. If he didn't have those steals, I think people would have been cutting him by now.
Yeah, like if he had 7 steals. I don't know if they would cut him, because I think that the argument would still kind of be there. And there are so many people in our community who are just, completely they just completely shake off this slump. I mean, they say it reflexively, it's just like, oh, yes, Ramirez is fine. Don't even think about it. Like, it's completely dismissed. Like, even any concerns today about Ramirez are dismissed as foolishness. And I don't think it's foolish to be concerned about Ramirez at all.
I don't think it's foolish either. It bothers me when people say, well, just bet on everybody being who they've been. But players improve, players get worse, players gain weight, lose weight. Things happen to their eyes. They could be switching, vision, contacts, things off the field. 1 year, Frank Thomas had a horrible year because he's going through this messy divorce. I mean, who knows? It can be a million different things.
And what happened to Baerga at the same age? It's just so weird, isn't it?
Yeah, totally lost it. A guy whose OPS plus was in the all-star level, and then it dips down to 108 in 1995 at age 26, and then they traded him in 1996 to the Mets, and they pretty much got the Mets holding the bag. And
what's his career OPS plus? Baerga?
100, a average player.
And what was it for the Indians?
For the Indians is 109. And that was really hurt by his last couple of seasons there. But
okay. So right now for his career,
for the Mets it was 78.
But I bet if you looked at it through age 26, it was probably about 117, 118. And that's exactly where Ramirez is right now for his career, 117.
He played a year with the Red Sox, 73 games. I do not remember that at all. Bounced around Boston, Washington, San Diego Padres, Arizona after the Mets experience. But again, he was pretty much done.
And also a great strikeout profile like Ramirez. Not the walks.
Yeah, never struck out. Never struck out at all. Yeah, that's a great point. It could be bye-bye for Baerga. It could be bye-bye for Ramirez. That's the end of our baseball part of the portion of today's podcast. If you just came for the fantasy baseball, for all the great nuggets we're getting from Michael Salfino, you are welcome to check out. But this is where we have fun. This is where we let our hair down. We go to our 5-round draft. And Mike and I, being of a certain age, we have a lot of – he's more of a 70s guy than I am because I kind of caught the second half of that decade. But we both are good friends with the 70s sports guy on Twitter. And we spend a lot of time talking about some of the stuff that we grew up with, players who colored our formative years as fantasy fans. So today's draft is going to be our favorite 70s athletes. We're going to pick 5 each. I'm going to give Michael the first selection, all-time 70s athletes from Mike Salfino.
I'm going to have to go with the king of, you know, the Rucker Park, who is Dr. J. Like, to me, like, mm-hmm. That's a slam dunk first pick, 1970s all-star. Like, he pretty much embodies the 1970s in my mind.
You know, the thing with Irving to me that is both kind of cool and frustrating at the same time is the idea that so much of his greatness is just lost. It's a memory to the people who were at Rucker Park. It's a memory to the people who had ABA access. There are a few games that are every once in a while classic sports would show an ABA game. I remember seeing a championship game where Bobby Jones, kind of at the peak of his powers, was guarding Dr. J, and Irving was just torching him. And it wasn't just with dunks. He was torching him with three-pointers, torching him with fallaways. It just seemed like he could score whenever he wanted.
Rebounding, block shots. Like, he did. He was, yep. He played the entire court.
I feel it's a little bit it just bugs me a little bit that his best years, when he really had the spring in his legs, because he had a lot of physical problems, he was still a good player in the NBA, won an MVP in 1981, didn't win the title until they got Moses Malone on board. And he might have been too deferential, I should say, with that first 76ers team he went on. They had George McGinnis, they had a young Daryl Dawkins, they had Doug Collins, Steve Mix, Henry Bibby was kind of overmatched at point guard. You can't watch those 1977 finals on YouTube and you see the Blazers playing wonderful team ball and you see Philadelphia just kind of going one-on-one. McGinnis was just not a good player, put up a lot of points, and eventually they stole Bobby Jones for McGinnis a couple of years later. But he's a great pick, Julius Irving. And of course, you can see the lineage of the NBA, right? It goes from Irving to David Thompson to Michael Jordan. I mean, Jordan idolized Thompson, and Thompson is really the next step from Irving, you know, a player who came on.
And they were sort of they had that epic slam dunk.
Dunk contest.
Yeah. So to me, like, I view them as almost that. Obviously Irving predated Thompson. But the other thing too is you know, a lot of this is geography, which used to be so important in fandom, which is completely irrelevant in today's world. But I live in the New York area, so the Nets were always on, like, Channel 9. Like, they were broadcast a lot. So I saw a lot of Dr. J when I was a child in my formative sports years. And the guy was just, you know, amazing. Like, they weren't on as often as the Knicks were, but they were on enough to feel like you were experiencing that entire trip. And also, the other thing that people don't realize is the Knicks had the option to just take Irving from the Nets in lieu of the $3 million payment for the geographical rights to the NBA, and they turned that down.
There's a great what if. What if Julius Irving ends up on the Knicks?
Because the Knicks already had Spencer Haywood and McAdoo. It was mostly Haywood. They were just like, we have Spencer Haywood, we don't need Dr. J.
McAdoo was one of those classic players that looked like you wanted him until you got him, and then you realized you really didn't want him.
Oh, don't look. McAdoo was almost going to be my pick, but I just could not go over Dr. J. McAdoo was amazing, but, you know, obviously he had flaws, but he became such a great player when he moved on to the Lakers because they were able to utilize, even in his declining phase of his career, his great shooting ability and his just overall game. And the fact that he was now McAdoo is a player in today's game. Oh my God, would he translate? McAdoo would pretty much be Kevin Garnett in today's game.
Yeah. Ultimate stretch four, or stretch five, a guy who could shoot from anywhere, always get his own shot. They said his shot looked like a small guy putting a pizza in a tall oven. But of course, he was going to dominate the ball as well. I don't always draft these things competitively. If I wanted to get my ideal team, I wouldn't pick this guy now. But since you picked a basketball player, I'm going to pick a basketball player on my list. I'm going to take Bill Walton, who is somebody, because Walton's real heyday was before, just a little bit before my time, things that happened historically during my being alive, but not during my awareness period. I'm just fascinated by guys like that. And you had Walton was at UCLA, kind of straight laced. I know he was listening to the Dead on the side and doing all sorts of Grateful Dead related things on the side too. But then he goes to Portland, the ponytail, the facial hair, he's hurt all the time. Maybe he's tied to Patty Hearst. Maybe he's tied to political radicals. Then he kind of cleans it up third year. They win the title, youngest team at that time to ever win an NBA title. A basketball player who could be the center of your offense and defense. Bob Ryan, the great NBA writer, has often said that the best of Bill Walton he thought was the most valuable commodity. If you had to defend, the way Ryan would frame it, if you had to defend the world against Martians and it was a basketball game, you'd get the peak of anybody. He would take Bill Walton. I argue if that's true or not true. I mean, there's a lot of great centers and a lot of great players, but that's how much Ryan thought of him. But to me, Walton, just fascinating. You know, he was a stammerer and a stutterer. Marty Glickman helped him clear that up. Now he's a respected announcer. He's got a real joie de vivre. Listen sometime to his Bill Simmons podcast with Walton from 2008 or so. Doesn't matter if you like Simmons because it's 95% Walton. And every time I need a refresher on life, I plug that podcast in. I'm just, everything about Bill Walton fascinates me.
Yeah, that's a great pick. I mean, Walton is kind of like a what if story too. And
yes,
to me, like, you know, we were talking about Bayerga and Ramirez. To me, the comp for Walton right now is obviously Joel Embiid. And, you know, that guy just cannot stay healthy. So it doesn't matter like how great you can be when you play. It's just the old saw, like the most underrated ability is availability, right?
That's a great one. That's a great one. Yeah, that Blazer team won the title in 77. They were 50-10 the next year, and Walton's feet started to go south. And, you know, I guess he's had chronic foot problems. His body just wasn't made. You always worry about big men, too, if they're going to age well. That's why Kareem is such a freak of nature, because he was such a good player for such a long time, where players at that height, a lot of times their bodies seem to get shot really quickly.
My second pick, I'm shocked you didn't take this with your first pick, but I'm going to have to go Bobby Orr.
I wasn't going to take him. I'll tell you why. I feel it would be just wrong. It would be not fair to latch on to Orr when I wasn't old enough. And there's some sports writers who claim they really appreciate Bobby Orr's career. This is a big bone of contention with me. I was a huge hockey fan, a huge sports fan, and I just feel like I was a little bit too young for Bobby Orr.
But do you have to – this is a philosophical question, like, because you had mentioned this to introduce this segment. Mm-hmm. I don't really think you need to have actually – experience the player live, especially with the tools that we have today. And you, like I, have always been really interested in the history. I'm sure that you were thumbing through your pages of the Baseball Encyclopedia right when I was. Mm-hmm. Obviously me with the sports cards. We have YouTube highlights. So I was approaching this question differently as just which players from the — it would almost be like, who were the best bands of the 70s? Like, would you have had to have seen the bands? I guess that's a little bit different because you're hearing them, but I don't know. So I went with Orr just because how could you leave Bobby Orr off a list like this?
Yeah, he's kind of like a Led Zeppelin, right? Where a really short, concentrated peak and then poof, it was gone. You know, I've eulogized three people in my life. I've eulogized my mom. I've eulogized a friend's mom. And I eulogized Fred Cusick, who was the Boston Bruin longtime announcer. And the classic Fred Cusick announcing moment was always when Bobby Orr would go on one of his crazy end-to-end rushes. And interesting, the famous Bobby Orr goal, kind of a callback to what we're doing now with the Bruins playing St. Louis, that was actually against St. Louis in the 1970 finals. Orr got the puck, passed it to Sanderson, back to Orr. Orr snaps it in the net, trips over a guy's stick, goes flying through the air. And now if you go to Boston, if you go to the New Garden, there's a statue of Orr flying through the air. That'll be, could be the classical image. And a lot of people argue, again, Bob Ryan would say that Bobby Orr is the most important hockey player of all time because he played offense and defense, and he doesn't want to hear Gretzky. As much as so many people will say Gretzky is the best player of all time, some people will still say it's Howe, and there are a ton of people who will say it was Bobby Orr. Defenseman back in the day, if you got 20 points from a defenseman, you were good. You were a good offensive contributor. Mostly this wanted you to mind business in your own end. The idea that you would have the puck on your stick and try to skate it end-to-end and play offense like Orr did. And there's also, I wish we knew accurately how much Orr played a night, because people said he played like 40 minutes a night. I think that's possible. I don't know if that's realistic or not. There's really probably no way to measure it.
Yeah.
A defenseman now would play 20, the best defenseman would play 25, 26 minutes a night, maybe a little bit more in the playoffs once you don't care about necessarily preserving their body because the game's so important. I wonder if Orr really did log those 35 or 40 minutes a night. Also, I grew up with Ray Bourque in the 80s, so not that he's better than Orr, but he was a pretty good guy to latch onto too.
I was swapping some cards around, and I was looking through the cards that I collected when I was a kid, which are still in really good shape, and they're, you know, in plastic sleeves. And I have one Orr. I forget which year it was, but it's a Blackhawks Orr. And I turn over the back of the card. It said 10 games, 13 points. Like, I mean, Orr was still performing at right. that level of points, like per game, like when he was basically playing like on no knees.
Yeah, it was almost like a guy out there without skates. You know, it's like he's playing in work boots and he was still controlling the game. You know, if we ever do a draft someday about most just strangest uniforms of players associated with one team, they end up on another team, Bobby Orr and the Blackhawks would be a high pick because that never looks right. I like the Blackhawks.
You should do that, by the way. That would be a good
That would be a good draft. I think that would be really fun. And you know what? Sticking with that theme, another guy, great guy to pick would be Reggie Jackson, who played a year in Baltimore. And I love the Orioles bird and all that, but Reggie Jackson never looked really right in that uniform. But he spent the 1976 season there, played out his option, obviously signed with the Yankees in 77. And even though I was a diehard Red Sox fan and remain one to this day, something about Reggie. I mean, the guy has this massive ego, but he's incredibly sensitive and insecure. He could be really thoughtful and a decent guy, and other times he could be a real just kind of horse's ass. What's better than those three home runs in the 77 series? He hits two missiles to right field in the lower loge, and then he hits the Charlie Huff knuckleballer to the black seats. Just, man, what a monstrous home run that was. And a lot of people forget in that Bucky Dent game in 78, Jackson actually provided the winning run with a home run to center field off Bob Stanley. A lot of success in the World Series, of course, even when it wasn't home runs. I mean, he had that base running thing where he got in the way with the double play ball in 78.
Well, he's the MVP of the 73 World Series, which people forget.
Yeah, with the A's. Yeah, a lot of people forget that. And the MVP of that season, too, could run a lot. Just a fascinating guy, a contradiction. And aren't those the most interesting people, the contradictions? So my second pick is going to be Reggie Jackson.
Best stat about Reggie that seems like it's made up. We did the podcast on The Natural for The Breakfast Table, you and I, and I referenced this then because it seems mythic. But Reggie Jackson hit a home run on five consecutive swings at Yankee Stadium, and four of those swings were in the World Series. And then he homered on his first swing on opening day in 1978. That's insane.
To a hailstorm of Reggie bars.
I mean, but think of how is that even possible to homer on five straight swings? It's like even in home run derby, you would be like, this is insane.
And even when Reggie failed, it was fascinating. Like in the 78 series, when he had that duel with Bob Welch and Welch was throwing him all the heaters and Welch ended up striking him out.
That was maybe one of the great at bats in baseball history.
It was. And Reggie's into a pretzel, right? When he would strike out, his body would look in the, I love baseball photos where you see a contortion of a body and you're like, how did he get in this position? Like Bob Gibson's follow through.
Yeah.
It's like, how could your body get where it's at right now? When Reggie would strike out, his body would be contorted in this way. You would think he was he was being killed on Batman, you know, where they sent him to some yogi and he had to like twist his legs together. I just thought the guy was fascinating. He didn't always do the right thing. Sometimes I think he was railroaded. He went to a 77 Yankees team that didn't really want him. Martin was the worst possible manager for him. There was a click on the Yankees that he never was going to break into. And of course, Jackson didn't handle it right either. You know, he got his feelings hurt really early in that season and said a lot of things he shouldn't have said. But when the, you know, a lot of people are going to argue forever that clutch hitting doesn't exist. I'm going to maintain that Reggie, if there was a clutch hitter, man, it was Reggie Jackson.
My third pick, and you can see the theme here. Like I just went one sport for every, mm-hmm. I added a fifth sport. So my third pick is going to be, I had to pick somebody for football. If it wasn't for all the off field mayhem, literally, allegedly, I would have picked OJ, but I'm mm-hmm. good. But you can't do that obviously. So I'm going to go with Mean Joe Green, who not only he was the main member of the iconic unit of 1970s football, which is the Steel Curtain. He was also somebody who translated culturally because of the Coke commercial, which if you were to pick, you know, the top five commercials of the 1970s, that would probably be one of them. And
even today, if you ask people, you went on Twitter right now and said, name yes. the five commercials that that still resonate with you, that would get a lot of play.
And rightfully so, right?
Mm-hmm. They should bring that back. Coke should bring that back. They should just run that all summer. People are all football season. People would love that.
That would be amazing. So I'm gonna go with him. Like, and he was also
they could have Antonio Brown like firing a shirt at somebody. No kid, you can't have my shirt. Get out my Coke.
but you know, number one overall pick, I think, or was he the second pick in the draft?
I thought he was the first pick. I'll double check that.
But you know, just and pretty much a player who, if you could have like a patient zero, the start of the Steelers dynasty began with the selection of Mean Joe Green.
It did. He was the fourth overall pick in the 69 draft.
Fourth overall. What a steal. He went to a small school, didn't he?
He went to North Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it comes to the Steelers for me, Green's a great pick. It's funny how that maybe the best defense they had was that Steelers team that went nowhere, the 76 team, where a lot of guys on offense get hurt. The defense at some point in the middle of the year said, you know what? Nobody's scoring on us. I think they had five shutouts in the final nine games of the year, allowed like 29 points, something comically low. The guy in that defense who always did it for me was Lambert. He was part of that great 1974 class. I think it went Swan in the first, Lambert in the second. They didn't have a third pick, and then they took Stallworth in the fourth pick with their fourth round pick. And the famous story was that they got a tape on Stallworth, who went to a small school too. I think he went to Alabama A&T, and they were so blown away by Stallworth's tape, they were supposed to give it back to somebody or maybe forward it to somebody. And they said, no, we're not showing this to anyone because we know we're never going to get them if anybody else sees this tape. So that tape stayed with the Steelers, and then they landed all three of those guys Pro Bowlers. It's still considered maybe the best draft in NFL history. So a bunch of fascinating guys. I almost picked Bradshaw. I'm a huge Stallworth guy. Obviously, Lynn Swann was, you know, picture perfect for the Sables and NFL films, all those graceful catches. And just really, I mean, a lot of times teams win titles and they get too many Hall of Famers. I don't think that's the case with the Steelers. I think they deserve all the Hall of Famers that they got.
Yeah, and there maybe could be even a couple more. But yeah, I'm adding it up now. So that's 25 points in their last nine games.
Just absurd. Absurd. And with Toothless, Jack Lambert, second in the MVP voting that year.
He was more like the cherry on top to me, though. Like, he was obviously the quarterback of the defense and an iconic player in his own right. But that defense was already on its way to greatness when Lambert came. He was just like the ridiculous added Hall of Famer to an already soon-to-be iconic unit.
Well, 1976 MVP voting went Burt Jones first, Jack Lambert second, and then my guy, who I'm going to take in the third round, Ken Stabler, the 74 MVP, the 76 MVP, and of course the Raiders finally got over the hump that year, 13-1 in the regular season. Patriots blew their doors off in one game, and then of course the Patriots probably should have beaten them in the playoffs, but they didn't. Raiders won easily over a banged-up Pittsburgh team, the AFC Championship game, then they beat Minnesota in the Super Bowl. But the thing with Stabler, He had really good stats in Oakland. He didn't get the job until late into his 20s. Eventually went to Houston, and it just totally fell apart. He threw 28 picks his first year in Houston. But Stabler, even though he had some really great stats, look at the index quarterback rating for 74 and 76 for Stabler. You'll see him right next to the best of the Manning years and the Steve Young years. That's how good Stabler was. But he's really more about the type of guy he was, the study the jukebox by the study the playbook by the light of the jukebox, played hard, partied hard, did a lot of things to his body, probably shouldn't have. I think it probably speaks to why he wasn't much of a player in his mid to late 30s, but just a fascinating guy and beloved by his Raider teammates. I mean, he was a ringleader of a team that had all sorts of characters, played for John Madden. To me, the Raiders, and I grew up in New England. It wasn't like I had any affiliation with them geographically. I just thought that team was filled with so many cool guys. I wanted to be a Raider fan. So I rooted for the Patriots, but I also rooted for the Raiders. And I always rooted for Stabler, even when it went bad. He hung on a little bit too long. Ken Stabler, to me, was the coolest guy in the NFL in the 1970s.
Yeah, and definitely was the best quarterback in football in 1976, 1977. Like there was no doubt that if you asked anybody,
74 too,
right? But what, like at that point, once he cemented himself with that Super Bowl championship, everybody would have agreed that Stabler was the best quarterback in the game. Which is, you know, to me, that's something that needs to exist for a Hall of Fame candidacy. At
he
some
had
point.
That yellow jersey, and you think of things like a lot of my opinions of the '70s, especially stuff that I wasn't necessarily able to watch. Remember, thinking, you know, media is so different then. Sports Illustrated was a big part of how I digested the '70s, both then and today. And you think of who would be on the cover for a Sports Illustrated football preview issue. One year it was Joe Green. One year it was Ken Stabler. One year it was Roger Staubach, another guy who was just incredibly good for such a long time. Took him a while to get the job. At one point, he was splitting the job on a series-to-series or even snap-to-snap basis. But once the Cowboys got on board with Staubach, what a great career. He was still playing at the top of his game when he retired.
Yeah, he could have been he would have been probably a really good choice too. I'm going to go baseball with my fourth round pick and Tom Seaver, who
Fresno,
you know, just dominated the 70s. Basically, started right out of the chute. You know, his 1971 season was just epic. That was the year in which he had the 19 strikeout game against the Padres, where he struck out the last 10 batters. Like, think about that. Like, you know, the all time record for the most strikeouts to start a game is 8, and that's something that's just epic and almost unbelievable. But imagine striking out the last 10 batters. How much harder that is.
In an era where it was a scarlet letter to strike out, everybody was trying so hard to not strike
exactly.
out.
Exactly. It was like, you know, shame. You were shamed. There's no shame in striking out now. And that might be good or bad, but
I don't really like the shape of today's baseball. I know you were ranting a little bit on Twitter about basketball with all, it's all three pointers
and baseball
now.
And football. Yeah. Like, football's going to join that too. And look, man, I know that it's that you should pass more and that teams are inefficient, but the problem with analytics is that everybody ends up playing the same way.
That is a great point. You know, I didn't watch all of the NBA Finals game too, but one of the best parts of that game is when they went box and one on Curry, just because nobody ever does that in the NBA. It was just so nice to see something different that felt like a unique experience. Because as you said, the efficiency problem is it means everybody wants to play with the same blueprint.
Right. So just as far as Seaver goes, that 1971 season, which to me is one of the greatest pitching seasons in baseball history, is 20-10 with a 1.76 ERA, 289 strikeouts, 61 walks, 194 ERA plus, 1.93 FIP, 0.946 WHIP, and he threw 286.1 innings. Like, his WAR that year, and he didn't win the Cy Young Award that year. Ferguson Jenkins won it, and you would think that that's like an outrage, but I think Seaver was 10.2 WAR for a pitcher, which is insane, and Jenkins was like just a tenth of a point behind him.
Did Jenkins have more innings?
Probably, yeah. Jenkins,
and that's a part of it. Plus, he probably got credit for pitching in Wrigley Field, that probably gave him a WAR bump too.
So, and that would have been the fourth Cy Young Award for Seaver. So, you know, Seaver led the league in FIP ERA 4 times. And, you know.
Was that your favorite Seaver season? Were you old enough to enjoy 69?
No, not at all. I just remember being a kid and walking past somebody's house who was listening to the game or watching the game on TV and having the announcers talking about how many guys in a row Seaver struck out. And I remember being excited by that because I had just started to collect baseball cards and I was a Mets fan. But I did not see any of that game. I don't know if I was like on my way home from school. Like, who knows? Like, there's so many fragments of memory at that age. But I did not experience that season at all. The 73 season, I was in California for most of it. I came home back to Patterson with my family for pretty much the last 2 months of that season. But and I remember watching a lot of that year at my grandmother's house. And then in 75, that was his last Cy Young year. I watched a ton of those games.
Do you remember where you were during the trade? He was traded that famous 1977 swap.
It was midnight, remember, when midnight he was traded.
Midnight Massacre, right? Yeah.
But yeah, I was always a person who stayed up late. That some things never change. So I remember watching. You knew that Seaver was going to get traded. So I stayed up and I watched Eyewitness News, and then they broke in with the press conference where Seaver, you know, was famously tearful. And Kingman also was traded in that trade, and he was another guy who Mets fans really liked a lot.
Traded that day, you mean? He wasn't in the same trade.
But... No, yeah, traded that day. And Kingman, I think that year became the only player to ever homer in every division.
All four divisions, yeah. Right? Right. Little spoiler here. Next week's guest might be a big Dave Kingman fan. You might be able to put two and two together on that if you know who's out there. I'm going to take a New York athlete in the fourth round also. I don't think there's any chance you were going to take this guy, but I'll take Giorgio Canalia, the great striker for the Cosmos. And really, I liked Canalia just fine, but really he's just a proxy for – he was my first introduction to soccer. Back when I remember he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 1979, again, my journal of record. I remember getting a news quiz question right in school where I knew that Canalia scored 7 goals in a playoff game. And you know, soccer goals do not exactly fall from the sky. So it's hard to score 7 goals, even with the NASL having a liberal offsides rule. And I think there might have been a couple of penalty kick goals in there, but still, that's just absurd. Soccer documentary on the Cosmos is fascinating. They get Pele at the very end of his career. He doesn't necessarily mix that well with Canalia. They had all the other stars on the team, Carlos Alberto, Franz Beckenbauer. They tried to get Cruyff. They couldn't get Cruyff to come over there. He didn't want to be one of the Cosmos. But Once Upon a Time in America, the Cosmos story is fascinating. It's a really good book, really good documentary. And Canalia, a lot like Reggie Jackson, you know, he was great. He was sensitive. He put the numbers up. He backed it up. A lot of people didn't like him. A lot of people on his own team didn't like him. But you couldn't argue with the record. And he made a young kid like me, Cruyff, the way Cruyff played was more appealing to me. But because Canalia was such a force of nature and he actually burst into the media spotlight enough to be on the cover of a Sports Illustrated, he had a lot to do with me growing up with a love and an understanding and even a knowledge of soccer. So I'm going to give him my fourth round pick.
I'm going to go. You mentioned how I rate the cards for Tops, and it's usually baseball cards, but they gave me a tennis Hall of Fame set.
And okay.
I was just like, really? Hall of Fame, man? You're picking the wrong guy. But, you know, it was pretty much just a reporting exercise. So the cards came out great, I thought. I learned a lot about tennis, and I did really I did watch a lot of tennis in the 1970s because people forget there wasn't that much to watch. Like, you didn't have that many options, you know, if you like sports. But I'm going to go with Borg as my fifth pick.
I was thinking about Borg too. You know, one of the first great athletes to walk away early. We know Jim Brown did it a generation prior, but it. You know, he still was at the top of his game when he decided to walk away. Those matches with McEnroe were impeccable. Of course, there's the Borg-like character in the Royal Tenenbaums, where the character basically dresses exactly like Borg. Fascinating guy. Played a style I really liked, too, because the whole idea of Borg was for him to wear you down during a point. And I think I started to fade out on tennis. I was a big tennis guy, too. I watched McEnroe's career with much interest in him going up against the end of Borg and I played it. I think everybody I grew up with who I was friends with, I think we played tennis at some point. It wasn't our primary thing that we did. You know, we'd probably rather play golf or hockey or whatever, but we all played tennis. We all had a racket. You could get a match almost anytime you wanted. And once the sport started to become about just the serve volley and the points being really short, I know sometimes McEnroe played that way too, but like when Sampras got really good and the point was over immediately, or, you know, Goran Ivanisevic became one of the better players and he would just have this knockout serve and ace people. That wasn't interesting to me. I wanted to watch long.
Well, that was equipment basically too, right?
Yeah, that's equipment too. That's a great point. The equipment did change. And it made the game.
Remember,
different.
Borg came back and he tried to use the wood racket. McEnroe was like, "You're out of your mind."
Right. He tried to use the wooden racket. So great. So great. Borg's a great pick. In fact, it makes me tempted to pick McEnroe. Although I
but
feel
he's
like
more
McEnroe's
he's more 80s, right?
80s. I was going more 80s, to. Yeah. There are a lot of guys I was considering that were more 80s. I was thinking of cheating with Ralph Sampson because he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 79. But he's really an 80s guy. I'm still waiting for the great Ralph Sampson doc. I considered Steve Grogan, Patriots. As much as people hate the Patriots now for winning and having things that I get you, I understand why people don't like the Patriots. That's fine. In the 70s, they were a joke of a franchise. Something always went wrong with them. They lost like 9 overtime games in a row, which was an NFL record. It may be 8 or 10, but just a lifetime of futility. They lost money on the Jacksons tour. They couldn't have Monday night football games after a Steelers Patriots game became a drunken fest. And then there's only one way out of Foxborough Stadium. Just a total, total nightmare. They used to play in the stadium that was, you know, the seats were metal and they were uncomfortable. And there's a million things went wrong with the Patriots before they became the most hated and most successful franchise in American sports.
Just like the things that are soon to go wrong again for the Patriots. We all wait with bated breath.
I don't care now. Anyway, I almost took Grogan, beloved New England sports figure. I almost took Earl Campbell.
Yeah, Campbell would have been a good pick, but he had such a short peak.
Mixed message on Campbell because I watch his running style and I'm blown away by it. But then I think of how much pain the guy must be in now. He can hardly walk. Yeah. But he doesn't regret any of it. You know, Bum Phillips ran him into the ground. Campbell said, "Hey, that's fine, man. I wanted the ball." Couldn't really catch it, but he could run it. And look at some of those YouTube highlights. You see a 3 or 4 minute clip of Campbell. They will blow you away. Another guy who was on the cover of the Sports Illustrated football preview issue was Campbell. I'm going to take a player who I really didn't see much of. But to me, he symbolizes what the 70s sports experience is. And if that guy who runs a Twitter account ever switched his icon to this, I think it would make perfect sense. He's got that great Steelers image up, which is a riot. But to me, I think 70s sports, I think Dick Allen. I think of that Sports Illustrated cover of him smoking, wearing a helmet, and juggling. And he's got the mutton chop sideburns. And he was a guy who marched to the different drummer and didn't always, wore out his welcome in a lot of different cities. But I think he was misunderstood. I think he has a Hall of Fame case that's probably not getting its due. Just Dick Allen was a cool dude. You know,
he sort of straddles the 60s and 70s, but I like the pick a lot. Like he definitely fully blossomed in the 70s because he was a 72 MVP for the White Sox.
Right. So that's our draft. Anything interesting left on your board?
Obviously, there's just so many guys to choose from. I
hate that I didn't take a hockey player. I almost took the 79 Rangers, your team that went to the finals.
I was thinking maybe of Esposito or Guy Lafleur, but then it was just like
Lafleur would be
fake.
A great pick.
That would have seemed fake for me. Like, I just didn't really, you know, it's not like I've ever sat there and watched a bunch of Lafleur stuff like I have with Orr.
The great thing with Lafleur and with Orr is just, you know, no helmets. And they're skating down the ice and their hair is blowing in the wind. It's just, yeah, not me with Orr so much, but Lafleur, you know, the flower, right? What a great nickname. He was so graceful and he had this unbelievable shot. The Bruins could never beat the Canadians back then. They had a good chance in 79. They were ahead late in game 7. They got a too many men on the ice penalty and then Lafleur blasted a power play goal to tie the game and they lost it in overtime. But the Canadians felt like, do you think sports are better off with dynasties? And the hockey had a lot of them in the 70s. The Bruins, the Flyers, the Canadians won 4 in a row, and then that turned into the Islanders, and then that turned into the Oilers. Are sports better off that way? Or are they worse off?
No, they're worse off. I'm so sick of the Warriors. Like, I don't care, like, how, you know, I don't like the style of today's NBA game, like we were talking about before, but I'm just sick of the Warriors every year at this stage of the season. Like, I want to see, it's the marvelization of the NBA. You know, every movie, every climactic event in the NBA stars the same people.
Yeah, it's a celebrity league too, right? I think one reason the NBA is so popular is people want to feel like it's such a Hollywood league. It's such a TMZ league. It's such an Entertainment Tonight league. It's such a red carpet league. And every time for a minute, I think, you know, it'd be cool if Toronto won. Then I see Drake at courtside acting
I hate the Drake thing.
My
colleague, yes, my colleague Andrew Beaton at the Journal, they sent him to the game just to track Drake. And they tracked every time he stood up, sat down, how they timed it with a stopwatch.
Sent him to cover Drake.
He was standing for 40 minutes. They timed like how long. He didn't come back in the second half until there were like 8 minutes left in the third quarter. So, you know, so much for being like a super fan. And I kidded with the writer, Andrew. I was like, man, Drake's going to hate this article. And he was like, really? I don't even think he read it. I was like, first of all, let me tell you, in the Wall Street Journal, this guy 100% has read this article, and he's 1,000% hated this article, because the whole thing really, and you know, he's got tattoos. Do you know Drake has tattoos of Durant and Curry on his body? Think about that. Now, Drake is a super fan for the Raptors, right? Now, say I was a super fan for the Jets, but I had, you know, a Gronkowski jersey. A jersey,
tattoo. I want the matching Brady to Gronkowski tattoo on your back shoulders.
Right.
That would be awesome.
But what I'm saying is that would completely invalidate me as being a rabid Jet fan, right? If I had a Gronkowski jersey that I wore. And I like Gronkowski, so I'm picking a player that I like. But it's just, you can't do that, right? Besides, you never wear a jersey of a player that's younger than you. But that's beside the point. But a tattoo, that is way more than a jersey. You just can't. I'm sorry. Like, to me, do you agree with me that that invalidates Drake as a rabid Raptors fan?
Oh, I'm out on Drake. You look at his Wikipedia page, and there's this like 18 paragraphs and all the beefs he's had with different people. That's a skill if you want to make it in that world. Is you first thing you do is get in a bunch of public arguments with as many people as you can.
That could be my Wikipedia page, in fairness.
Yeah, you're kind of like the Drake of the fantasy, environment right now.
Right.
You know, you mentioned Drake. Let me close on this. Surprised you didn't pick any New York Knicks. And there's a team that later on had a real noted super fan in Spike Lee. Of course, William Goldman is a famous Knicks fan. Brian Koppelman often talks of how much he's been. That's how he met Koppelman, met Goldman, as they're both Knicks fans. I thought maybe we would have seen a little Clyde Frazier.
I thought it would have been faking it to pick the championship era Knicks, since, mm-hmm. you know, I moved back and forth. I lived in California for a while for the 73 championship run. I wasn't even in the area. I was going to pick McAdoo. He was the guy that I felt like, you know, when I was a kid, I made a McAdoo jersey out of a T-shirt to use, like when I played Nerf basketball in my room and listened to
that. Interesting. I would have thought that 73 team would have been your Knicks team.
Well, I was in California. I lived in a desert.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because, I mean, talk about if you like team basketball. And that's why I love that Blazers team. Again, watch those YouTube tapes. Bobby Gross going backdoor and having a field day on the Sixers, who were just, you know, all the Sixers really cared about was offense. What a poorly coached team they were, despite all the talent they had. But the Blazers playing together as a unit. I love team basketball. I know if I had grown up old enough to be around that Knicks team, I would have loved, you know, I would have loved DeBusschere. I would have loved Bradley. I would have loved Clyde. I just, that's my type of basketball team. Okay, we'll put a period on it at that. This has been a lengthy podcast. You always have a great conversation with Michael Salfino.
And we do this, Mike, all the time on the breakfast table. So
yeah, tell everybody out there how they can keep up with Mike Salfino.
Well, you have to become a member to listen to me and Scott do our thing weekly for fantasy and for other things. And that's via at Patreon, and you could find out about that at the breakfast table podcast Twitter page, which is @breakfast_pod. And you could just follow me on Twitter at Michael Salfino to see all the things that I'm involved with and links to my various stories.
Yeah, you're being too kind, because I mean, you've written for a lot of important websites, and again, the Athletic content is outstanding. We teased some of Mike's Athletic stuff today. So look, I don't pay for a lot of things. You should subscribe to the Athletic. It's as simple as that. Thank you, Mike, for coming on the program. As I said earlier, we have a great guest, a Dave Kingman-loving guest lined up for next week. For my guest, Michael Salfino, for Brett Rader, for putting up with me and getting us on the air and sounding great, I'm Scott Pianowski. go the 70s SI Vault. Go look at some Dick Allen covers. We will talk to you soon.